It's here and now. A merger to create the world's largest consumer products company is in the works. Cincinnati-based Procter & Gamble, the maker of products such as Tide, Crest, and Pampers, has reached a $57 billion agreement to buy Gillette, the Boston-based maker of razors and batteries, a merger pushed in part because of the influence of Walmart. But what does it mean for consumers, for employees? Joining us on the line is Robert Berner, correspondent for Business Week magazine. And Robert, first, this is a friendly merger, correct?
Yes, it is. It's a match made in heaven. P&G, it's a 168-year-old company. If you look at its brands, they've always been pretty much female brands: Tide, Olay,
Pampers,
mm-hmm. and now they're going to be able to move into male grooming. So they're at the same time they're buying the world's most dominant blade and shaving company, Gillette. So this is going to give P&G a lot of opportunity to move some of the existing brands into male categories. For example, it could perhaps take Olay, its female skincare line, and launch a male skincare line with Gillette.
Well, you say match made in heaven, but not for the 6,000 workers who are expected to lose their jobs.
That is true. That's what you see with all of these deals. In the long term, it'll be better for both these companies because the consumer products industry is incredibly competitive. It's overcrowded with competitors. Everybody's scrambling for sales growth. P&G and Gillette are the two strongest companies by far, so this will make them even stronger.
Well, explain how Walmart has been a factor in this merger.
Well, what's going on globally in retail is that it's consolidating. Walmart, of course, is the world's largest retailer. It accounts for 25% of P&G's overall business, and there are other large global players like Carrefour in France. And this will give P&G more bargaining power with Walmart because it'll have a wider range of products. So that makes Walmart need P&G even more.
Mm. You write in a Business Week article that both companies have been coming out with product-based gadgets. Procter & Gamble with the Swiffer mop. Gillette has the Mach 3 Power Razor. It can be powered by its own Duracell batteries. What is that trend, and what does that mean?
Gillette also recently launched the Hummingbird electric flosser. It's reaction to the forces within consumer products of how slow sales growth is and how hard it is to gain profit power with major retailers. So one aspect of this strategy is you can sell gadgets for a lot more money than you can, you know, your basic household chemical cleaners. P&G has really been leading this trend. There's another element to it in that it creates a different relationship with a brand. You can, for example, with Crest was a toothpaste. With the launch of the Crest Spin Brush electric toothbrush, it was a power brush that was fun to use. So it added another dimension to the brand that can make the consumer more loyal to it. That's the reason all these companies are trying to head in this direction. Not only have you seen Gillette do that, but you're seeing SC Johnson, you're seeing Clorox with its tools for cleaning toilets with snap-off heads that makes cleaning the toilet a lot easier than in the past.
Well, Robert Berner of Business Week magazine, we see reports that show the Boston Gillette executives are going to get big stock options, at least $124 million for the CEO, $41 million for the vice chair. What does this mean, though, for the consumer, for the people who buy Pampers and toothpaste?
I don't think it will mean that much in terms of pricing because consumer product industry is just incredibly competitive. I think they could see more new products from a combined P&G and Gillette. P&G has been probably leading the pack in terms of innovation, and this will give it a lot more ground to consider innovation on all of Gillette's products.
And for our Boston listeners, while we have you, Gillette is based here in Boston. It's assumed that many of the cuts are going to take place here in Boston. This is one of a series of mergers that have affected Boston-based companies. Does that change the way Boston is viewed by the business world, as all of its world offices, home offices, are gobbled up by outside companies?
I think a lot of metropolitan areas are wrestling with that across the country. Seattle lost Boeing to Chicago, for example. I don't think it will hurt Boston because it has such a strong tech base and a strong educational center with MIT and Harvard, which are, you know, there's constantly new startups that are coming out of those universities, particularly MIT. So long run, I don't think it'll be a problem.
Except, of course, if you lose a job.
Right? Of course, right. Unless you lose a job.
Right. Robert Berner, correspondent for Businessweek magazine. Robert, thank you.
Thank you.
Two days ahead of historic elections in Iraq, officials there say they've captured three more close associates of terrorist leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. Yesterday, Zarqawi's followers posted a video on the Internet showing the murder of a candidate from Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's party, and they have vowed to kill anyone who takes part in Sunday's vote. But despite that, election workers are getting ready for Sunday as U.S. and Iraqi forces surround major cities with blockades in an attempt to prevent suicide car bombs. Abdul Salam al-Madani is training election workers in largely Kurdish northern Iraq. He's in Erbil. Hello.
Hello.
Are you Kurdish yourself?
Yeah, I'm Kurdish.
Well, how is the security situation in your region there?
We have so many checkpoints, and the city is semi-blocked, in fact. Today, for example, there were a series of cars around the city in the checkpoints coming from Kirkuk and Mosul and Duhok, probably. It was about 500 to 1,000 cars. They cannot get inside the city because it's a new security plan to block all cities before the elections, starting from yesterday, but today it was so strong, in fact, and probably tomorrow will be more blocked. No other cars came from any other cities from Iraq can be entered in any city, especially Erbil.
Well, Abdul Salam, how are people there feeling about that? It must be causing havoc with people trying to get around, or maybe they appreciate the safety.
Yeah, the people inside the city, yes, they are. They feel better. But as you know, the feeling better doesn't mean that they are in a safe, because nobody knows from which other road the bombed man or bombed car can enter the city.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe he came before, for example, 3 or 4 days or 1 week enter the city and waiting for the day.
Right.
Nobody knows.
So a car bomb could be already inside the city despite the blockade. Who is holding the blockade? Are they Iraqi police or American troops?
In Erbil, they are Iraqi police.
How's it going? Are there voting stations? Are ballots ready? Have you got ballot boxes?
Yes. Yes, we got them, and I mean everything is prepared for the day of the elections, monitors, campaign, polling stations, polling centers, the boxes, the ballots, everything.
Do you think people will come out to vote?
In Mosul and Tikrit, the voters are very afraid, and you cannot see any kind of election campaigns from the parties, anything. You
right.
cannot even feel that there is elections there. And for example, today, especially in Mosul, all the city from 4 o'clock p.m., nobody was on the streets, just the American troops. It was so difficult for our monitors to work there. So we don't know what is the ratio of the participants in the elections. In Kirkuk, it's a little bit better, in fact. And the three other governorates, the people, and you can see the election campaigns from the political parties, and you can hear the horns of the cars, the people coming outside and celebrate of the elections and making their campaigns, the voters, I mean.
Right. So
the election day, are they going to vote? I think yes. The problem will be there will not be any car on the street in the election day. Maybe this will affect on the ratio of the participants.
So the blockade might be a factor. Fear might be a factor. How do they feel about the politicians? How do they feel about the people they're voting for? Are they compelled by any of the candidates?
you will see the people will go to vote because they are huge members in political parties. But when you sit down with them and ask, do you think that will be a great change after this election, especially in the North, for example? They will say, no, we don't think so. Mm. But this is the situation here. This is the mentality. The people will participate, especially in the North. But do they believe that there will be a great change? No.
Hmm. Well, it's funny, Abdul Salam. Some Americans listening might say, well, we have that sometimes here, too, where people,
yes.
Yeah, you know, where they vote because it's their duty, but they may not think there's going to be change. Abdul Salam al-Madani is training election workers in northern Iraq. We're speaking to him from Erbil. And I just, Abdul Salam, why did you get involved in this? I mean, we're hearing that people are, you know, entire election committees are quitting in some towns because their lives have been threatened. Do you fear for your life? Do you fear for your life?
Oh, fear. No, in fact, to me, myself, I'm doing my job as a human being. I believe in democracy, and I believe in new Iraq and the new world. It's a war. There are some people trying to kill innocent people, trying to put us in the dark eras, and we are dreaming of a new day. The elections must be happened. We are going toward the democracy. If I sit down, my brother sit down, my family sit down, and everybody sit down, it doesn't mean that our situation will get better. No, the dark worshippers will lead us. Mm. We are full of dictatorship. We are trying to lead ourselves by ourselves.
You say you're fed up with dictatorships. Fed up? Full up? Have had it with them?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Abdul Salam al-Madani training election workers in northern Iraq for this Sunday's democratic election in Iraq. Our producer, Stefano Katsonis, who you know well, told us to say to you, Shukran Aini.
Shukran Aini, okay.
Wait a minute.
No.
What does that mean, Abdul Salam, to you, Shukran Aini?
Shukran Aini means thank you, my eye. The eye is an important organ from the body. So in our culture, when you tell somebody that you are my eye, it means I respect you, I like you, you are in my eye. I keep you in my eye, in my heart.
Well, we keep you in our eye, Abdul Salam. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Thank you very much. You're welcome.
And just ahead, the view from Baghdad, a check-in on security ahead of this weekend's vote. And later in the program, why do so many U.S. workers reject the union label? There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Continuing our look at Iraq 2 days ahead of Sunday's historic election, we just spoke with an Iraqi election worker, now Borzu Daragahi. He reports for the Boston Globe and CBC Radio and for Here and Now. He's on the line from Baghdad. Welcome, Borzu.
Hi. How are you guys doing?
Just fine. And we just heard from Abdul Salam al-Madani. He trains election monitors in the north of the country. He spoke of it being dangerous in Mosul. There is much reason for that. A videotape was released yesterday, we understand. And in it, terrorists associated with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi execute one of the candidates from Prime Minister Iyad Alawi's party, warning Iyad Alawi, you traitor, wait for the angel of death. How is that being received?
I think that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi has been rather poetic in the past in his threats against Alawi, whom they seem to despise with a particular brand of venom. I remember one declaration. They said that they had prepared a special poison just for him, just for Alawi. You know, they've been targeting political candidates all over the country, the insurgents. They've been targeting election workers. They've been targeting even people who are out there polling. Pollsters are being targeted.
Well, we understand Mosul in the north, snipers are setting up to protect voters. Ballots and ballot boxes are being distributed by armored American military convoys because nobody else wants to drive around with them to be a target. There have been decoys that have been set up to deceive the insurgents into believing there are polling places in one place, but they're going to switch them to other places on Sunday. But on the other hand, in Basra, in the south, the party closely identified with Ayatollah Sistani, the Shiite Ayatollah, are parading through the streets campaigning. So it's very different there.
It's quite a different story in Iraq, Shia South. You got to remember that these are people who have been deprived of power and privilege and property for decades under Saddam Hussein's regime, and now they taste the power that's about to be handed to them. They also, for many people, they see it as their religious duty. I mean, you know, the equivalent of the Pope, maybe even more powerful than the Pope in Shia Islam, Ayatollah Ali Sistani, has basically ordered people to take part in the vote, and has said that, you know, if you happen to die or be killed while you're taking part in the vote, you will be a martyr and automatically get a spot in heaven.
Well, let's talk quickly about some of the other names that we've come to know and are curious about their participation in the election. The young firebrand Shiite cleric Muqtada Sadr, is he running or does he have a party?
He doesn't have a party. He's not running, but he's kind of straddling the fence. He's being kind of a clever politician in many respects. He's not preventing his followers from running in many lists of candidates. You know, so I mean, he's basically having it both ways. You know, on the one hand, if the elections turn out to be successful, he'll have his people in parliament. If they turn into a disaster, he'll be able to disassociate himself from it.
Ahmed Chalabi, the darling of American neocons, who was behind the war effort in the first place, is he running?
Well, he's running on the Shia list. He's kind of reinvented himself as a Shia leader. I don't know what kind of popular base he has, but he's managed to work himself in within Iraq's new political class so that he's pretty much guaranteed a seat in the 275-seat parliament.
We want to get your sense as well, Barzu, of what kind of news reaches Iraq. Senator Edward Kennedy made comments yesterday saying that the White House should pull U.S. troops out of Iraq after the election, that U.S. troops have become a part of the problem in Iraq. Republicans are saying Kennedy's comments were unhelpful and gave courage to insurgents right before the election. Are his words being received over there? Is that something you're perceiving?
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's one number out there that 70% of Iraqi households now have satellite dishes, and that's up from zero before the war. And with those satellite dishes, they're able to watch Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, Al Sharia. They might be, in a way, over-inundated with news and so on. So I'm certain that they've heard Senator Kennedy's remarks and are absorbing it.
And what kind of impact do you think they have?
I don't know. I think there's a lot of Iraqis who, as much as they despise the presence of U.S. troops here, are really worried about what would happen if they were to suddenly pull out. As for whether it heartens the resistance, I don't know. I think from what I understand and from what I get from my meager sources within or close to the resistance, there are two minds. On the one hand, there's the nationalists who would love more than anything for the U.S. troops to leave. On the other hand, there's the more hardcore jihadis, the religious fundamentalists, who are just pleased as pie to have these soldiers here in a Muslim country. It's a big, huge, as far as they see it, a big, huge recruitment ad for them, and it sort of confirms their most conspiratorial theories about America and the West and its designs on the Middle East. And many of them were rooting for Bush to win in order to have a rallying point.
Borzu, just briefly while we have you, President Bush has said that he would withdraw the 150,000 U.S. troops from Iraq if the new government formed after Sunday's vote asked for that, but he says he doesn't think the country's new leaders would want that. Just briefly, your sense of the leadership, will they want the troops to withdraw?
In the words of some Iraqis, they're the ones who came in on the tanks of the troops, so why would they want them to leave?
And one last question. Are you hearing, we heard earlier from Abdul Salam, the election worker in the north, who fiercely wants to vote, believes in democracy, and believes that he and his family should risk their lives to fight the dark forces of the insurgency to vote for democracy. Are you hearing that determination elsewhere?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, even my translator, he's very actively wanting to vote. That's very true. You know, among a lot of people, they want to vote. They want to participate in democracy. Now, I heard one person say, if I don't vote, who will? But yet, you know, when it comes down to it and they weigh the threat, not just to themselves, but to their families, I bet you're going to see a lot of people have second thoughts about taking part in this election.
Well, we will see with the help of you. Borzu Dorogahi reports for the Boston Globe and CBC Radio and for Here and Now. Borzu, thanks very much.
It's been a pleasure.
And next time on Here and Now, the votes will have been cast, so we'll review the results. Also, conservative groups in the U.S. say they want more action from the White House on same-sex marriage. That's next week. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Look for the union label. For years, it was a slogan and a command. But as reporter Matt Bai writes in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine, many workers today don't want to be labeled union, and one of the biggest critics of the union system is one of its own. In his article, The New Boss, Matt profiles Andy Stern, the president of the largest and fastest-growing trade union in the country, the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU. And Matt Bai joins us on the line. Welcome.
Hey, Robin. How you doing? How are things in Boston?
Things are fine. Things are snowy. And you write that 50 years ago, a third of American workers belonged to a union. Now it's 1 in 10. But the SEIU keeps growing. What makes that union different?
Well, a lot of things, but largely simply an economic shift. I mean, as the name implies, the Service Employees Union is for service employees, and that means the people who clean your hotel room or your office building, the people who are nurses at your local health care clinic. I mean, this is the new economy, in a sense. It's the post-industrial American economy, and that the SEIU really represents that. And so while a lot of the other industrial unions have been losing members, and there are a variety of reasons, and SEIU has been a very innovative union, I would say the main reason that SEIU has been successful over the last couple of decades is that the American economy has changed dramatically, and these are the workers out there
and then there's
representation.
And then there's Andy Stern, also post-industrial. He's not a person who came up the union ranks in the usual way. He's the SEIU leader. What's Andy Stern's biggest criticism of the other union bosses?
What Andy Stern will tell you about his fellow union leaders is that they've been too attached to their power and their perks and their position in democratic politics to actually think differently about how they're going to benefit workers. You know, these unions have been losing members as a percentage of the American workforce for decades. You know, mostly they've continued to do the same thing they've always done with little tweaks, and there's really not a great incentive for them to change the way labor works, and yet at the same time, life for workers is getting harder and harder. And so what Andy Stern says is, we got to stop blaming Republican administrations, stop blaming globalism, stop blaming this and that, and start taking responsibility for the status of the American worker.
In fact, one of his suggestions would be to pay less money to the big umbrella organization, AFL-CIO, and the big bosses, and use that money on the local level for the unions, which right there he's suggesting undercutting that power structure.
Yeah, and the reason for that is his big investment is in organizing. I mean, this is a sort of intra-union stuff, but basically, if you were going to boil it down to its simplest form, most unions are putting a lot of money now. The AFL-CIO is putting a lot of money into policy training and political activities and training on how to collectively bargain for its local unions. And what Andy Stern is saying is the best place to spend your money, the only way to get real power in America if you're a union, is to add members. And you add members by identifying and organizing new markets. And what he wants to do is drastically reduce the amount of money the AFL-CIO takes, essentially taxes, if you will, from its unions, give it back to the unions on the condition that they use a big chunk of it to go out there and organize new workers in their sectors.
Well, tell us more about Andy Stern's thinking about what unions should be.
Well, it's really interesting and counterintuitive. Andy Stern is an Ivy League educated, a white-collar worker who was a social service worker by trade, and, you know, who believes that in a new era of multinational global companies that you have to take a strong line and you have to look for creative ways to get leverage against companies, but at the end of the day that you have to bring added value. You have to make it viable for companies to pay more to their workers. And so he thinks more like a businessman, and he tries to approach the issue of organizing workers and bargaining with employers more like a businessman.
You quote the head of the machinist union who says, I think he's trying to corporatize the labor movement. He must be a fan of Donald Trump. I think he wants his own TV show. And many people, you use the word arrogant, call him arrogant. What's his sense of what will happen to labor if they don't shift?
Well, Andy Stern says our movement, meaning the labor movement, is on the verge of extinction, and the American worker doesn't have time for me to be careful about choosing my words. You know, his point is we're going out of business in 20 years if we don't change as a movement. He has a great sense of urgency about it, and he has demanded that the AFL-CIO embrace a very sweeping structural reform, and if they don't, he's essentially said that he'll take the SEIU and he'll leave.
No, and then let's explain. AFL-CIO, that's the umbrella over unions,
right.
And he's proposing merging unions so that the AFL-CIO would consist of 20 large unions instead of, 50-plus smaller ones.
Right. I mean, the AFL-CIO is what we talk about when we talk about big labor, and what he's saying is not only should we encourage unions to go out of business, we should be folding them together aggressively so that instead of having 58 unions, many of whom are too small to affect the kind of change he wants to affect, he says, you know, some of you guys need to give up your power, give up your perks, merge with other unions so that we create 20 big unions organized by sectors of the society, one or two that do healthcare, one or two that do aerospace, etc. This is a huge challenge to the existing order of labor. It's made him, in some circles, a very unpopular guy.
Well, what are some of Stern's other ideas for unions, if you could tick them off? For instance, how would they fight globalization?
What Andy Stern is talking about is a federation, a little bit like the AFL-CIO, but instead of being made up of American unions, it would comprise unions from around the world. The idea here being that if you have a company like, for instance, Walmart, which is not only the largest employer in the United States, but controls a lot of the manufacturing industries outside of the United States, overseas, where so many of its products are made, that you can't simply take on Walmart by mounting a campaign in the United States. You need unions in the countries where it operates in concert with you to sort of take on the operations of that company in those countries. So that is his vision for sort of making labor as global and as multinational as the corporations they're trying to negotiate with.
Matt Bye, you said that Andy Stern has made some enemies because of his call for wholesale reform of the labor movement. But I'm going to put you on the spot. What's your sense? Is he right in the suggestions that he's making?
Well, I think, you know, it does put me on the spot, but I think I make it pretty clear in the piece that I do think he's right in some sense. I couldn't sit here and tell you whether I think all of the specific proposals are right for the labor movement or not. There are people who know more about that than I do, a lot more. But I can tell you that I think he's right in the most central piece of what he's saying, which is that we need to be having a conversation as a country, as a political system, as voters and politicians. People need to be talking about how globalization is going to work with our economy and how the United States is going to move forward from its old economic model to a new one. There are very few people putting forward visions, new ideas of how American workers are going to prosper in a new global world. There's a lot of political people scoring points off it. There's a lot of people blaming each other. But when you can sit here in Washington and talk to people for months or years and never hear anybody say, I've got an idea, I've got an affirmative, innovative idea for how American workers are going to be okay in the global economy. And that's what Andy Stern is doing. What he's really doing is starting a conversation about how it is we shape the 21st century to benefit us economically in the way that the 20th century did. And somebody's got to do that.
Matt Bai is contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine. His profile of Andy Stern, the president of the largest and fastest-growing trade union in the country, SEIU, appears in this Sunday's New York Times Magazine. Matt, thank you.
Sure, anytime. Thanks, Robin.
Still to come, a tour of the house architect Philip Johnson built as a graduate student at Harvard, hidden all these years behind his huge fence. You're listening to Here and Now. A children's television show is pitting the new U.S. Secretary of Education against a cartoon rabbit named Buster.
Hey Buster, where you want to? What you want to? Buster?
Postcards from Buster, which is produced at WGBH here in Boston, is funded mainly by a federal initiative called Ready to Learn. The current controversy is over an unaired episode in which the animated bunny visits real-life children in Vermont. Their parents are lesbians, and the show features maple sugaring and other aspects of the family's farm life. But Education Secretary Margaret Spellings has denounced the show, saying many parents would not want their young children exposed to the lifestyles portrayed in the episode. In this, her first week on the job, Spellings wrote to PBS asking it to refund federal money spent on the Sugar Time show and adding the department would clarify its expectations for future programming it funds. PBS has decided not to distribute the footage to its 349 member stations, although WGBH is making it available to stations, some of whom, including WGBH, have decided to run it. Here in-house Bob Oakes spoke this morning with Peggy Charon, founder of Action for Children's Television and a member of the board at WGBH.
Let me ask you, first of all, Peggy, your take on the new education secretary's denouncement of this.
I think it's really shameful that right out of the gate, the new education secretary is doing the opposite of what her job should entail. Here's a program that was funded by the Department of Education that is about inclusion, making all the kids in the country feel part of what's going on in this country with families and feel good about themselves. And her first act is to exclude a category of children and families. It makes you worry about where we're going with education in America.
Let me ask you to specifically respond to Secretary Spellings' concerns that the program does not meet the objectives of Congress to use television to prepare school-aged children for school.
The concern seems to be that it doesn't meet the grant guidelines, which is ridiculous. It couldn't meet them better. The idea is to make children across America feel warm and fuzzy about who they are, by saying these particular children, this particular program, shouldn't be aired, you're excluding a family format from that mandate. The fact is that this is just what television should be doing and can do for kids. You know, the stuff about parents in these shows, it's the background. What's important is what it says about children and the children in the show who are such a diverse collection that it's really amazing they could find so many different families to talk about in the course of a half hour with an animated host.
Given what you say, Peggy, what about the PBS decision to not distribute the program?
I tend to sympathize with more speech rather than less speech in almost any case. And by not distributing the program, you don't leave families, you don't leave anybody the option of deciding for themselves whether this is something they like or don't like. Besides which, I have seen the program, and I can't imagine what caused them, Public Broadcasting or her, Ms. Spelling, to say, this is the one we're not going to air. And the fact is that the program isn't about living in a family with lesbian parents. It could be. I think that's a perfectly reasonable subject for a show, but this is about the way we live in Vermont. in this very open space and how we get together with friends. And that's just in there. You know, the way you make maple syrup is just in there. The program is so full of wonderful things to learn about. And one of them is this young family has two mothers. I do not think that's going to make anybody's hair fall out.
Why did GBH, WGBH-TV, decide that it's going to air the program?
I understand that there are 11 or 12 stations going to air it, including New York and Boston. I think the good news is that the stations do have the option to run it, even if they didn't get sent the program by PBS.
Peggy Charon, founder of Action for Children's Television, talking with Here and Now's Bob Oakes. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
He's got his camera and he's going to explore all the new things he's never done before. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hey, Buster, where you up to? What you up to, Buster? Where you up to now, 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 now?
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When renowned architect Philip Johnson died this week at the age of 98, I immediately thought of 9 Ash Street. In my neighborhood in Cambridge, Massachusetts, there's a corner lot completely enclosed by a 9-foot fence. Legend has it, inside is the house Philip Johnson built for his thesis while at Harvard in 1942. Now, you may be thinking, oh no, Johnson's thesis was his lifelong glass house home in New Canaan, Connecticut. But actually, the Ash Street House was the model for that home. 9 Ash Street is now owned by Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Tribe and his wife Carolyn, who lived next door and used the glass house as an office. Wednesday night, Carolyn and I trudged through the snow, past the stately Victorians and the shingled homes with bay windows and turrets that have stood since colonial times, and opened the 9-foot gate. Oh, look at that.
Open the door off the street, and it's the street's right there, the brick sidewalk is right there, and the cars are behind you, and you turn, and right there you have this broad expanse of house.
80 feet left to right, beautiful, lit up. It's like a stage set left to right. There's compartments which aren't fully divided, but from the front you can see them all. There's a bedroom on the left, mm-hmm. and then an office right in front of us.
Which is also his dining room.
Mm-hmm. And then Larry's office, your husband's office.
Which is actually the living room with the fireplace. Yeah.
And you see it all left to right. It really does look like a stage set with 4 different scenes.
Exactly. Particularly, very excellent description, particularly in the dark.
Huge pieces of glass mm-hmm. Across the front, and only about 30 feet deep and about 15 feet tall?
At most, 15. Right.
And when you think about the other houses around here, which are Victorian and have dark rooms and hundreds of them and, you know, tiny little corridors and small little doors, this must have just
knock their socks off.
Professor Tribe was waiting inside the house with his collection of Philip Johnson books and letters that tell the story of 9 Ash.
Well, he says, why did you build it? I built it just for fun. I didn't know it was going to be my thesis. We had trouble. The wall is against Cambridge code. My luck was that I built it first, and the neighbors objected afterwards. They'd seen the plan. They'd never have let it go. And he said it's ideal for lovers because you could just go back behind the world and no one could see. And he used to sort of marvel how some of the elderly citizens of Cambridge would peek underneath this 9-foot-tall fence to see if they could figure out what was going on.
In fact, one time I was coming from Harvard Square, and I saw this large troop of people marching down through the streets. Well, it's easy to follow a crowd, so I went right behind them, and I was amazed. They all stopped right out in the street in front of the house, 9 Ash.
Their destination, apparently.
Their destination. It was an architectural course. And this person was explaining to some 30 or 40 people what this was all about, yet he couldn't see a thing.
But again, when this was built, what did people say?
Well, he says that they were speechless. I guess people were annoyed that he could do something kind of this interesting that was prefabricated and that immediately made a statement and that was had an indoor-outdoor feeling and that really was much less expensive than, you know, building an ordinary house in Cambridge, and that he was only a student.
How did a student get this plot of land and the ability to build a house?
Well, he was, an older student, and he had come into some money from his family.
I think he also had very close connections with the Museum of Modern Art in New York City.
Yeah. It was his thesis house. I mean, he did it as his doctoral dissertation. And then when he was asked, was the architectural community thrilled that Harvard was engaged in this kind of program, he says, oh, no. And then he basically sort of disses his own house. He says, I left out everything the way beginning architects always do. No storage, no attic, no basement, no place to put anything, which is certainly true.
Philip Johnson once said he was glad Lawrence Tribe hadn't received a Supreme Court nomination because that would entail a move to Washington and someone else might knock the Cambridge House down. They became friends, the tribes often visiting Johnson at his more celebrated New Canaan home to talk about 9 Ash Street.
He had a great sense of humor. We asked him, would it really be aesthetically harmful to put a skylight right in the middle of the living room? And he said, no, it would be aesthetically just fine. Only one problem. The house would collapse.
Couldn't support it?
Who knows? Well, it is, in fact, it was an unusually structured, prefabricated thing. He was one of the first houses that were fabricated elsewhere and then kind of brought to the site. And it's, well, a lot of it is just sort of one large frame in which apparently there really is some equilibrium issue that would be caused if something happened to the roof.
Well, let's describe it because, in fact, it does look like a wide body, whatever those big trails, in some way. I mean, it's beautiful, but it is basically one large rectangle with a wall of window.
Yes, it is. I think it was a very new piece of kind of architecture for the United States. It's post-Victorian, obviously, during World War II, but after World War I and all this destruction in Europe, a lot of the glass building-type structures evolved and were built, and this is in that mode. Mies van der Rohe has done the Barcelona house somewhat similar to this.
He was Johnson's mentor in some ways?
Mentor, right, and wonderful architect as well.
His mentor was Mies van der Rohe, and his mentee is Frank Gehry. He once told Carolyn and me that he thought Frank Gehry was the only great architect alive in America. And we said, well, what about you? And he said, I'm not great. I'm very good, but I'm not great.
Yeah.
Really?
He had a wonderful sense of humor, a beautiful light quality about him. I really regret that such a light, such a brilliant person, and such a delight as a personality, such a wonderful human being has passed.
He certainly had some ideological affiliations in the past with some pretty scary and fascist things. I think he clearly outgrew that and regretted it. And he did live a wonderful, happy, full life. I mean, he was just an absolute impish type who obviously got great joy out of his last 10 or 15 years. I mean, it was, you know, you don't often see somebody in their mid-90s sort of bouncing about the way he did. This is one of the interviews of him when he's talking about this house. Well, what made you go to architecture school, which is where he designed the house? Desperation, he says. I wanted to do something, and I was a rich young fool wandering around in things I didn't know anything about. In fact, it got to the point where I wasn't doing anything at all. I thought of all the silly things. Why am I doing this? So I went to Harvard. You never know what he's going to say next.
Yeah.
I'm reading in the same book with a picture of this beautiful garden outside of the house. I thought I'd really accomplished something to build a prefab house. I sold it for $24,000.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Those were the prices back in the 40s. Yeah. If there were some way that it were economical to have it as a house museum, a home museum or something like that, I'd like it to become that.
Said, his inscription on one of his books is, for Carolyn and Larry Tribe, the good owners of my first and maybe best house. Thank you for your care.
How much a responsibility do you feel?
Enormous.
Oh, yeah.
Enormous.
We don't buy anything, even a piece of furniture for it, without thinking, will it really fit the spirit and the design and the sort of the, I guess, the Bauhaus
tradition.
Yeah, there must be a dollop of sadness as you stand here now.
Well, there is. I mean, it's the way life passes. I mean, the people who are interesting, the people who are wonderful, we all go. And it's just every time an interesting, lively spirit departs the scene, the place is a little less rich.
But he left things like this.
Yes. That's the marvel and the wonder of being an architect.
Well, thank you so much, Carolyn and Lawrence Tribe.
Our pleasure.
For letting me tromp through your Philip Johnson house. And for more information on the work of Philip Johnson, who died this week at 98, and for pictures of his work, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.